What I'm attempting to do today is to go into certain of the fundamental ideas of Purim and what the real fundamental essence of Purim really is, which I'm sure most people would like to know. I think most people tend to see Purim as the essential ideas, Mashalach Monas, Matnas Anim, and so on, dressing up in costumes and so on. They're all very important, obviously all part of the halachos of Purim, but in terms of the essential idea which Purim really is celebrated for, how do we understand that? This is what I want to try to go into today. But in order to understand Purim, one really has to go back to Kabbalah Sotera, Matan Torah, and you'll see the connection. Now, let's go back to Matan Torah. And there's certain very interesting inyonim when we think about Matan Torah. It says that the Yidin were makabel the Torah, and when they were makabel the Torah, they said Naaseh v'nishma, correct? But then later it says that the Rebbeinu Shlom had to take a tub and invert it over their heads like a mountain, Kofu Olehem Har Kegigis. And he said, if you accept the Torah, Mutav, and if not, Shom Teik for Aschem, here you will be buried. In other words, obviously what the Rebbeinu Shlom was doing was forcing them under the threat of death to accept the Torah or not. So how do we understand obviously the difference between Naaseh v'nishma and the idea of that the Rebbeinu Shlom had to force them to take the Torah? The Rishonim deal with this question, and their answer is that when the Yidin said Naaseh v'nishma, it was only in Torah Shebiksav. When the Rebbeinu Shlom wanted to give them the Torah Shebaalpeh, which is the oral law, there they didn't want to accept it. So there the Rebbeinu Shlom forced them by inverting a tub over their heads, a mountain over their heads, and said, the mountain Har Sinai over their heads, and said, if you don't accept it, you'll all be dead. This is the way the Rishonim ask the obvious stira between the what it says in the Torah and what it says, of course, in the Medrash, the Gemara, whatever. Now, it's interesting to note that really it's very difficult to understand for several reasons. First of all, Naaseh v'nishma is a Kabbalah. Why did the Yidden accept the Kabbalah by Torah Shebiksav? Whereas Torah Shebaalpeh, they didn't want. And the Rebbeinu Shlom had to force them to accept the Torah. That's the first kasha. Second kasha is that Naaseh v'nishma is a superlative Kabbalah. It was an excellent Kabbalah. They said Naaseh before v'nishma. We will do before we even understand why we're doing it in the first place. So the Kabbalah was a very good, it was an excellent Kabbalah. And for that Kabbalah, they got two kisarim, two crowns, the Chazal say. That they got two crowns because it's a Naaseh and v'nishma. So Adrabba, they had such a beautiful Kabbalah, why all of a sudden now, don't they want Torah Shebaalpeh? Third kasha is, wait a minute, then all goyim could say, if you forced us, we would also accept the Torah. I mean, what's the kunz? That the Jews are the ones who observe the Torah. You force us and we'll also have to do this. So like, you know, what does it all mean? So those are certain of the difficulties in the idea of Matan Torah. Let's take a look at Purim. Purim is a very interesting yontif. You know, it's really very difficult to understand certain aspects. Let's understand Purim by several questions. The first kasha is, what is the essential idea of Purim? What really happened on Purim that made it a yontif for all generations? First kasha, what is the real idea, the essential event that happened? Is it because the Jews were saved from Mordechai, by Mordechai and Esther, from Haman and Ahasuerus and so on? Is this what it's all about? Jews have gone through persecutions for thousands of times. This is not the only time they stood at the threat of death, right? So then, if that's the case, why all of a sudden is Purim so unique or stand out as opposed to all the other persecutions of the hundreds and thousands of years that Jews have gone through? Obviously, Purim has to contain something more essential, more important, that Chazal said, we are koveh it for yontem. First kasha. Second kasha. It's interesting that you find that Haman was an Amalek. He was an Amaleki, right? Or Agog, he was descended from Agog, he was an Amalek. All of a sudden, the enemy of Israel turns out to be an Amalek. Why? Why all of a sudden now, in the story of Purim, is the enemy of Israel turns out to be Amalek? What about all the other persecutions of Klal Yisrael? Is it always Amalek they're dealing with? what's the idea that Haman happens to be an Amaleki? Is it by design, by accident? It's something to think about. Third idea, why is the Nes of Purim Behesta? All the other Nisim that Klal Yisrael went through was always Nisim. In fact, you'll find even after Purim there was a Nes. The Inyan of Chanukah by the Nes of the Menorah was a Nes, right? The Menorah was a Nes, even though it wasn't directly related to the Kibush of the conquering the Greeks, right? Besides the fact that the Greeks conquering the Greeks itself was really a Nes, if you want to look at it, because of Miatim, Rabim Biyad Ma'atim, the multitude was captured by the minority. Okay, but even if you want to explain that away by saying great strategy and so on, but there were Nisim by Hanukkah, you had the Nes of the Nes. Clearly was a Nes. So therefore, why is it that Purim, which was such a great Hatzolah for Yidden, was only a Yidei Teva? There was no Nes at all. It was only Behester. Why? Another kasha is that it says that Purim will be the Yontif in Yemos HaMashiach. Purim will be the only Yontif celebrated. But anyway, that Purim will be the Yontif in time of the Mashiach. So the question is why? I mean, Purim is not even a Diraisa, and that yet that is the Yontif that is celebrated by Jews in Yemos HaMashiach. So really you have to understand how come. Also it says Yom Kippurim, that Yom Kippur is a date like Purim. Yom Kippurim is Yom Kippurim, a day like Purim. So if Yom Kippur is only like Purim, obviously Purim is greater. Why? How can Purim be greater than Yom Kippur? It's not even a deraisa. I mean, it's really incredible when you think about it. So we have these several questions on Purim that, you know, it's really important to answer. Obviously, if one doesn't have the answer, one is missing certain fundamental ideas of Purim. Let's begin to try to answer these by going back, even before Matan Torah, to some which I had mentioned previously, but I'm going to cover it again. When the Rebbe Hashem created the Bria, he made a condition with the Bria. He said, if Klal Yisrael accepts the Torah, or rather, if Yisrael accepts the Torah, mutar, good. If not, then it's choyzer l'soyev v'voyev. Then the universe goes back to chaos. It's the condition of chaos. Okay? Now the question, of course, is who was Yisrael at that time? Was he referring to the Ummah of Klal Yisrael, the present-day Jews? The answer is that it's not Klal Yisrael that the Rebbe Hashem is referring to. Yisrael is not an Ummah, it's a concept. Yisrael means Yosha Kael, righteous of God. In other words, those people, those individuals or those people who have agreed to observe what God wants, and they therefore will get Olam Haba, for them the universe was created. Because the universe was created for what? That man should have Olam Haba. Remember, Toiv, Meitiv. Man wants to be Meitiv, so man should have Olam Haba, right? But he has to work for it, so therefore Olam Hazeh is the place of work. So those people who agree to accept the assignment, they are Yisrael. You see? So Rav Hashem said that if there will be an Ummah, any Ummah that will accept the assignment, it was worth, that was the whole point of the creation of the universe. If not, then the whole Bria is pointless. Because there's no point in the entire universe being created, because man won't work for it, so therefore he's only going to accept the Rav Hashem's Hatova, only Ayadei, Bechinam, which the Rav Hashem doesn't want because of the embarrassment and so on. So therefore that's what the Rav Hashem made the condition. So therefore the Rav Hashem waited for Adam. And he waited all the way down to Avram. Nobody accepted the assignment until Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu accepted the assignment. He said, I am willing to work to get Olam Haba. So Rav Hashem says, okay, I will make a covenant with you. And the covenant merely means that you are the individual that I created the universe for, because you are going to accept the assignment. The whole union of the Bris Ben Absorim. Avram was the first individual who promised to carry it on to his children and on, to create a nation of observant people. So if the Rebbe decided to make Avram Avinu the first Jew, Avram or Ivri, he was the first Jew, because he's the one who accepted the assignment. Therefore the Rebbe made the Bris with him, the covenant, the agreement. But, wait a minute, even if you make an agreement with somebody, how do you know that he will keep it? Or his children, whatever. So there is an idea, a concept that if a tradition is held in three generations, it will remain always with that family, through all the generations. Even if it disappears, it will always resurface again. So the Rebbe Hashem waited until Yaakov. This is why, just to go back, this is why when we say in davening, we say v'harevno, and make it pleasant in our mouths and so on, and give the Torah v'tze'etzu einu, v'tze'etzu eit, tze'etzu einu, v'tze'etzu amcha beis Yisrael. It means give it to our offspring, their offsprings, and their offsprings, that's three generations. That, so therefore, then we know that Torah will be remain with us. The same idea of the three, the idea of three as maintaining tradition. In any case, so the Rebbeinu Shlom waited till Yaakov, and if Yaakov would observe the Torah, then you'd have three generations, and that's exactly what happened. Yaakov observed the Torah. So what did the Rebbeinu Shlom do? He made the agreement with Yaakov where he appeared to him in the Sulam, right, by the ladder, and his name was called Yisrael. Yaakov was the first one who was called Yisrael. In other words, the concept Yisrael was now descended on Yaakov. Why? Because he was the third generation of Avram. Therefore, the tradition of listening or accepting the assignment of the Rebbeinu Shlom would now be done. Therefore, Yaakov now can be called Yisrael. That's why nobody else before him was Yisrael. That's why when he fought with the Malach, he was called Yisrael. And why did the Malach, when he fought with Yaakov, which was really the Tsar of Esav, why did he fight with Yaakov and nobody else? Because Yaakov was the greatest threat. Had he not vanquished Yaakov, then Yaakov would be the third generation, and therefore Terah would always be, or he would keep the Bechira, the assignment of Terah. That's why he fought with Yaakov, not with Avraham Yitzchak. That's why he fought, and when he couldn't beat Yaakov, Yaakov beat him, what did the Malach call him? Yisrael. He won, the third generation won, he therefore got the name Yisrael. Okay? So now it comes out that Terah, or the assignment, was now accepted by Jews. Now, therefore, Yaakov can now have 12 sons, which is the beginning of Klal Yisrael. The union of us, of Shtemus Eshvotim, right, 12 tribes, now could begin with Yaakov because the idea of Yisrael had now been finalized. And now we begin to see the emergence of the Jewish nation of 12 tribes. Now, we come to Kabbalah Satorah. What happens in Kabbalah Satorah? The version comes down, he gives him the Torah. And the Yidden were murdig in the sense that they were makabal Torah bi'avo. They said Nasa v'nishma. Not only, how great was Nasa v'nishma that the Chazal say that they got two kisorim, two crowns. What was the union of the two crowns? I had mentioned previously. One crown is that they were masig yichud shlitosoy. They were masig the unity or the complete authority of the Rebbeinu Shlom as the only force in the universe. The second hasaga was yichud mitziusoy, that they were masik, that the Rebbeinu Shlom is the only thing that really exists. That's why the Yidden died. Remember the Medrash says that everybody died by Kabbalah Satorah? You remember that? Where they died by Kabbalah Satorah? So the Torah came to Rebbeinu Shlom and says, who you can give me to? Dead people? So Rebbeinu Shlom said, I will awaken them for you. Why did Klal Yisrael die? Because they perceived not only yichud shlitosoy, but yichud mitziusoy. So their mitzius was bottled. They died. If you perceive the mitzius of the Rebbeinu Shlom, what happens? The your mitzius is bottled. You leave your goof and you go back to the Rebbeinu Shlom. That's why the misa that happened by Klal Yisrael is a direct result of the hasoga they received. Why is it used in the name of keseh, two crowns? What is the signature? What is the sign of royalty? The crown. The crown is a sign of royalty, of kingship, right? So when you see the crown of the Rebbeinu Shlom, what does that really mean? You see the Rebbeinu Shlom in terms of that particular aspect that you're observing. So therefore, Klal Yisrael got the one keser, which is Yichud Shlitosoy. They saw the Rebbeinu Shlom as the only force in the universe, which means they saw the crown. That means to be Masig Yichudi means to see the crown. It means to see, to be Masig, the Rebbeinu Shlom. What part of the king were they masik? His absolute authority in terms of force or power. The second crown is they were masik the Rebbeinu Shlom, the king, which is the second keser, mitzad his mitzius, and then they all died. Okay, so we see that their Kabbalah was murdered. So then what happened by Torah Shabbat Peh? Why did they reject it? Klal Yisrael felt, apparently, that it's too severe on human nature to restrict them with such a tremendous amount of restrictions. Because Torah Shabbat Baal Peh adds to Torah Shabbat Tzeh immensely. Like I said, look at the difference between the Torah in terms of Mishpatim, the dinim of Nezikin, and look at the difference in Chosh Mishpat. to assume the mitzvahs or the obligations of Torah Shabbat Peh is far more difficult than Torah Shabbat Ksav. But the only reason why the Rebbeinu would give them Torah Shabbat Ksav is only if they accept Torah Shabbat Peh. Like Rabbi Yochanan says, that the Rebbeinu was only cursed bris only on Manas Torah Shabbat Peh, because that's the Torah in its totality. So therefore, but the Yidden was much too severe, so they said no. Not that the Yidden didn't want the Mekablet. V'horai, they were Mekabel Torah Shabbat Ksav with a tremendous, excellent Kabbalah. But they felt they could not assume the obligation of something that they really couldn't keep. So they said, we do not want it. We can't assume such an obligation that we feel we really cannot keep. But there was emerging also another idea, which we see. If Klal Yisrael felt that they could not accept the Torah, what they also perceived and what they believed is that the Torah is a method that the Rebbeinu Shlom gives, right, for getting Olam Haba. And it's also the Ratzon HaBore. But who says it's the only alternative lifestyle in this Olam Hazeh? There are many alternative lifestyles. Look at the Goyim. For every nation, they have their own culture, their own laws, their own lifestyle. Klal Yisrael did not perceive the Amitas Yichud Terosoi. They perceived the Amitas Yichud Metziusoi and Shlitosoi. But that the Rebbeinu Shlom's Torah, that what he's saying should be the way of life to Klal Yisrael, was not perceived that it is the only way of life. There is no other way of life. So even if it's hard, you must assume Torah. So you have to be Omel in Shvitz. That's the only way. There is no other alternative lifestyle. Klal Yisrael did not perceive that. So therefore, they rejected it in that sense. So the Rebbeinu Shlom, who knew that Klal Yisrael, that it is the only way, and Klal Yisrael did Mekabel the Torah, Nasa V'Nishma, okay? So he forced them to take it because the Rebbeinu Shlom knew that they can keep it, except right now they don't believe it. So the Rebbeinu Shlom is patient. He'll wait. La'osid loivu will come as man when Klal Yisrael will accept the Torah, Shebi'ah Peh, Bi'ava. When they themselves will perceive that they could accept it. So therefore, even though the Rebbeinu Shlom gave them the Torah Shebi'ah Peh, Ha'kigigis, the Goyim can't say force us, because they don't want any part of Torah. Klal Yisrael accepted the Torah in spirit. And they accepted the Torah Shebi'ah Ksav. But they felt they cannot keep all the incredible amount of laws of Torah Shebi'ah Peh, so they didn't accept it. But the Rebbeinu Shlom knew that La'osid loivu, they really can't accept it. So he says, right now I'll force you. There will be a Kabbalah B'yira, not B'yavo. La'osid loivu, you will see I was right. So this is what the Rebbeinu Shlom did. So if the Goyim cannot tie nor force us, because Klal Yisrael did accept the Torah, except they felt they cannot accept all of it. And Klal Yisrael wanted to accept Torah Shebi'ah Peh, except they felt they couldn't. So therefore we have an understanding of what was going on really by Torah, by the Matan Torah. Okay, so what does Rebbeinu Shlom do? He waits. He waits 800 years or 700 years until Purim. Purim was really the first time that the Yidden were in Golos, right? They were among the Persians, and they also were relatively free. After the Churban Bayis, right, they went into slavery under Nebuchadnezzar and so on. We find that by Purim, under Ahasuerus, they were more freer. They were not in the category of slaves. They were much more free in that time. Vaharaya, Ahasuerus makes a Suda of a feast, and he invites the Jews too. You don't invite slaves. Obviously, the status was very different. It wasn't, they were not, they were sort of like Jews in America in that sense. They were part of the citizens of the country. They were not slaves in that sense, where they were under Nebuchadnezzar, much more in Shibud. So what happens? What happens by Purim? Klal Yisrael all of a sudden, you know, for whatever reason, decides to enjoy the feast of Ahasuerus, which he had when he was appointed king, whatever, in terms of the Medrash. What when Klal Yisrael decides to join Ahasuerus? Well, there's nothing wrong with joining Ahasuerus by his Suda. He's providing kosher food and so on, or whatever. There's nothing wrong with sitting down with the Goyim and enjoying their success also. They also have a lifestyle. They also have a way of living. Torah may be superior, we believe that, right? But Goyim also have a lifestyle that makes sense in Olam Hazeh. That allows Klal Yisrael to join with the Goyim, which is what they did. It's almost happening in America, where, okay, you can go to Acapulco, you can do many things as long as there's kosher food. There's nothing wrong really with that lifestyle. So Klal Yisrael decides to join the Suda. What does Ahasuerus do? Chrysler realizes all of a sudden that after Haman arises, now they are going to be annihilated. But wait a minute. Not only are Goyim not appreciative of the fact that we want to join them, okay, want to show the recognition of their lifestyle and so on. Not only do they not accept us, on the contrary, they want to annihilate us. It's incredible. Goyim want to annihilate Eden. And what's the taina of Haman? They are Amaphorad. But that's incredible. They sat down by the Suda to join Achashverosh, right, to be part of the kingdom, and Haman taina is that they are Amaphorad. They stay by themselves, they don't fraternize with the Goyim. It's V'nahapichu, right? V'nahapichu, it's a hefach. Klai Yisrael wants to join the Goyim in that sense, be part of them, assimilate with them, whatever. And Haman uses the very opposite of what they attempted to do. And we'll see the idea of v'nahapichu, why it's such an important idea of v'nahapichu in Purim. But in any case, so the Yidden realized in a thunderbolt, the entire Klai Yisrael was going to be destroyed. Why? Because they thought the Goyim had something to offer. This is what the Goy does. So Klai Yisrael realized that without Torah, it's not Stam you don't have Torah because if you don't have the Torah. You're a barbarian. There is no other civilized kind of lifestyle if you do not have Torah. So Klai Yisrael realized that Torah is not only a means to Olam Haba. It's the only way to live in Olam Hazeh. It's what makes you civilized. Because look at Achashverosh. He was going to destroy him for nothing. They were all loyal people. They even wanted to join him by the Suda. So Klai Yisrael realized, and then it hit them, that there is no other method of living besides the Torah. Torah shall be our path. So they were masig at that point in time, because of the annihilation, that Achashverosh and Haman, the Indian of Amitas Yichud Teirosoi, it's not that the Rebbe Yishim is a Yochid and Shlita Metzias, but his Rotzen, in terms of his Torah, is the only way man can exist. That's the idea of the amito, the truth, the veracity of the yichud of his Torah. The Torah is the only law that man can live under. Anything else is barbaric. So Klai Yisrael realized. So Klai Yisrael made an about face and he will makabel the Torah anew. That's why Chazal say in the Yimei Achashverosh, in those days, they were kimu v'kiblu. The Megillah says kimu v'kiblu. So Chazal darshan, Kimu, they fulfilled Masha Kiblu Kva, what they had received previously. In other words, there was a new Kabbalah. Klai Yisrael was now Mekabal Torah Shebe'apeh Bi'avo, because they realized it's the only kind of way that man can live. So there was Purim, the greatness of Purim is that it's a new Kabbalah. It's a Kabbalah Bi'avo, which reverses the old Kabbalah Bi'ira. It was a gemar of the Kabbalah. It finished the act of Kabbalah bi'ava. And the Rabbanu Shalom in the end was right, because he knew in the end Klai Yisrael would accept it and they could keep it, which they have done for the past thousands of years. So the significance of Purim is not only in the events of Purim, it's the result of Purim. That a result of the annihilation, the fact that they were saved, they realize that Torah is the only supreme way of living. So they were makabel the Torah bi'ava. Purim is the gemar of Matan Torah, which preceded it by 800 years. That is the yisoid and the greatness of Purim. Kimui mashe kiblu kva. They fulfill the Torah. Now, really, what they were makabel 800 years before, bi'ava, they were makayim it, not bi'ira. Because what do you mean, kima shekilu kva? What does that mean? They were fulfilled what they accepted 800 years ago. They've been fulfilling that Torah for 800 years. But they were makayim it bi'ava, what they were makabel 800 years before, bi'ira. This is what the significance of Purim is. Now, let's see how this understanding lends us gives us the answers for the questions that were asked. We now begin to understand what the fundamental idea of Purim is. Is the essential idea of Purim is not only in its events, but more important in the result of the events of the Hatzolah. The fact that Yidden realized that Torah is the only way of life, even if it's difficult. So therefore you do it, even if it's difficult, it's the only way around. Because they observed what kind of civilization the Goy has. That as long as he doesn't have a a higher being or power over him, then he'll do whatever he wants. Achashverosh wants the money, so he'll kill the Jews. Therefore, the only way to really, in Olam Hazeh, to have a civilization is really to accept the Torah. And once that means, then you, of course, you accept the Torah in its entirety. There's no such thing as a half a code. So therefore, they accepted it, and that's what Chazal mean, came over Kiblu, and therefore it was Bi'avo, which, and the Rebbeinu Shlomo, of course, proved that he was right, 800 years later. That's why Purim is so great in terms of the fact that it became a Yom Tov. Because Purim is really the Gemar of Shavuos in terms of a Kabbalah Satorah. It wasn't Stam an Indian of persecution. It was the results of the persecution forced them in a certain sense to see the truth, and they were Makabal Torah Bi'avo. That was such a great awe that came down to the Bria as a result of the fact that the Klai Yisrael was Makabal Torah Bi'avo, that it was worthy to become a Yontif, Mamish. Because it wasn't the fact that they were saved from persecution. It was the rededication, the accepting of the Torah Bi'avo that made Purim such an incredible Yontif, besides the idea of persecution. But that goes many times that the Jews were persecuted. But Purim is the result of what they did. They re-accepted the Torah, and there was an incredible awe that came down as a result of that. This is the essential idea and the greatness of Purim. Now, besides that, the other questions that were asked, what about the idea, why was Purim behester? Because what the Rebbeinu Shem said to Klai Yisrael, you have not been mekabel my Torah bi'avo completely with all the gilui that I've given you. Remember Matan Torah, there's an incredible amount of gilui in Ha'orah by Matan Torah. And Alpha became the Eden. So the Rebbeinu Shem said to you, you will see that I am right. And not only that, you will mekabel Torah behester, not be gilui. What the Rebbeinu Shem showed them is that you will see I am right to such an extent that you will want the Torah behester without even seeing me. That's how right you will see I am. So therefore, the events of Purim are merely behester, where you don't see the Rebbeinu Shem. Because the Rebbeinu Shem is going to prove to Klai Yisrael that they will come to the Hasaga of the Amitas Yichud Teirosoi B'toich Hester, not B'toich Gilui of the Rebbeinu Shem, where it's far easier. So therefore, Purim occurred in Mishindik Hester, in order to allow Klai Yisrael to see that you're not taking the Torah because God revealed himself. You're taking the Torah because you realize that Torah is the only way. That's a far greater Kabbalah than to Mekabel the Torah when the Rebbeinu Shem shows himself completely, right? It's obviously easier to Mekabel the Torah when the Rebbeinu Shem shows himself the way he did by the Yam Suf and by Kabbalah Satorah, right? Much easier. So Rebbeinu Shem shows that you will see that I am right, but to Chmurdik Hester, that I was right. So therefore the events of Purim occurred between Hester, that Klai Yisrael should see that the Rebbeinu Shlom was right, and they were makabda even in terms of that tremendous Hester. Now, in terms of why Taka is Purim the only, Purim the Yontif of the times of Mashiach, because now we understand, what is the whole purpose of the Mashiach, the task? It's the Magal Yehudai to reveal the unity of the Rebbeinu Shlom Bishlemus in the Bria. At that time, everybody will see that only the Rebbeinu Shlom, he will be Echad, is throughout the Bria, Mitzad, Mitzias, and Shlit, and so on. So therefore, the Mashiach is Megala, the Yichud of the Rebbeinu Shlom, completely. There's no more Hester, there's no more Choshech. What is the Yontif of Purim really all about? The realization that the Rebbeinu Shlom is Echad in all his ways, even in his Torah, is the only way that Klai Yisrael can observe or live in society. In other words, Purim is the Gemar, the finishing, the completion of the Yichud Bishlemus, where Klai Yisrael saw that the Rebbeinu Shlom was one in every aspect, in his Metzius, in his Shlita, and in his Torah. It's all one, there is nothing else. Only what the Rebbeinu Shem offers is the only thing. So Purim, the joy that the Eden received in Purim was the realization. It was the shlemus of the Hasogas Yehudai. And that is the Yontif of the Mashiach, because he also brings the shlemus of the Yichud of the Rebbeinu Shlom. That's why Purim is the Yontif which is celebrated. The results of Purim, where the Hasogah of Yehudai is a Hasogah of Shlemus completely, The same idea, the Hasoga in Mashiach is a Hasoga of Yehudah also completely. It's the same, the message of Purim is the same Simcha by the Mashiach. Therefore, Purim becomes the Yontif of the Mashiach because it's really the same idea, the same message. In order to understand why is Yom Kippur Yom Kippurim, right? What is Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is Tshuva. What is Tshuva? It's a re-Kabbalah, isn't it? Where you makabal Omar HaShemayim, correct? But why are you makabal Omar HaShemayim on Yom Kippur? Because the aim of Din, the fear of judgment. In Purim, it's also Kabbalah of Torah. Why? Bi'ahava, it's a Meridik Simcha. So which is greater? Kabbalah Bi'ir or Kabbalah Bi'ahava? Obviously Kabbalah Bi'ahava. That's why Yom Kippur is a day like Purim. Because Yom Kippur also has a Kabbalah. Kabbalah is Omar HaShemayim, which is Tshuva. But it's Bi'ira, not Bi'ava. So therefore it's like Purim. Purim is talking the Kabbalah Bi'ava, you see. So therefore Yom Kippur is Yom Kippurim. It's a day like Purim, which means it has the same idea. Kabbalah is Omar HaShemayim. But it's not as great as Purim because it's Bi'ira, whereas Purim is Bi'ava. So therefore we now understand certain of the ideas. Why Yom Kippur is Kippurim, why Purim is the Yontif of the Mashiach, why Purim happened by Hester, what the essential idea of Purim in terms of its recognition that Torah is the only way of life. Now, we have one more question to answer. Now, why is Haman an Amaleki? So therefore, let's understand something about Amalek. Amalek is a very interesting parsha. Amalek is a very interesting ummah. What is Amalek? Why does God hate Amalek so much? We have to understand. Why does the Rebbeinu Shalom hate Amalek so much? That he's willing to destroy every man, woman, and child, even the behemoths, you have to destroy. What does he want? Why the behemoths? Because you shouldn't mention even the name Amalek. Say, that animal used to belong to Amalek. Not because the animal is guilty. Because it may cause us to remember that there was a nation Amalek. Get rid of it. So therefore, why is it that the Rebbeinu Shalom hates Amalek to such an extent where the Rebbeinu Shalom says in Bishalach that the Rebbeinu Shalom wars with Amalek, midor dor. God wars himself with Amalek in every generation. And it says, Mochoi emche, I will blot out Amalek, the Rebbeinu Shalom says. So we have to understand what is the uniqueness of Amalek that it's so connected what the Rebbeinu Shalom stands for. And the second thing it'd be interesting to know is, what about Esav? Esav was also a Rasha. What's the distinction in Esav that's different than Amalek? That the Rosham doesn't swear to destroy Esav in that sense like he swears to destroy Amalek. Amalek really, there's something much more evil or whatever in Amalek than in Esav. Not only that, it's interesting to see that Amalek is the grandson of Esav. Amalek was the grandson of an Esav. Well, how is it that Esav came first and then Amalek came third in that sense? He's a descendant of Esav. So they obviously they're related. How is Amalek and Esav related? Yet Esav is better than Amalek in the sense that Rebbeinu Shalom wants Amalek to be killed, whereas Esav, he will because of what they did to the Jews, but it doesn't have the same enmity that Rebbeinu Shalom has toward Amalek. Let's take a look at Amalek and Esav. What did Amalek do? Amalek is, in order to understand Amalek, and then you see how it makes sense in the Torah, Amalek is the quintessence or the personification of evil itself. Amalek is Ra. Amalek doesn't have evil, it is evil. What does evil mean? Amalek is the personification of man's omnipotence as opposed to everything else. The evil that Amalek is Gaiva Nifla, pure Gaiva, pure unmitigated, unadulterated arrogance or megalomania. In other words, Amalek thinks that it is supreme in the universe. There is no other being that it has to fear at all. It is what's called the arrogant man in its quintessence. Man's omnipotence personified in an ummah is Amalek. That is what the characteristic of Amalek is. Man's arrogance to the nth degree. That's why Amalek is pure evil, because it's the opposite of the Rebbeinu Shalom, which is Yichud Mitzius and Yichud Shlitosai. And Amalek is what? Is Ribui Mitzius and Ribui Shlitosai. Amalek is an ummah that personifies a multiplicity of forces. It's misnagi keneged the yichud of the Ribbono Shel'olam, and it declares its own supremacy against the Ribbono Shel'olam, against everything else. That is the essential idea of Amalek. Not only that, what did Amalek do? The Torah says that Asher korchu baderech, he met you on the way. The Medrash says that Amalek went over the lands of five nations to get the Klai Yisrael. So obviously Klai Yisrael was not a threat to them because it was near their territory. Klai Yisrael was not a threat because they were a strong nation, therefore possibly they can be a threat from afar, because you were tired. The Rosh is telling you, why did they go after you? They went after you to destroy you, because Klai Yisrael is now bringing the message to the world of Yichud Metzius and Yichud Shlitosoi. And this Amalek would not tolerate. They went after Klai Yisrael on their own initiative to destroy an ummah that was bringing the most dangerous message of all to the world that they perceived, and that is that man is not God, that there is a God above man. You see, that's the idea in the Shtetech and Torah in that way. That was this Timcha, you must blot Amalek, because Amalek is the antithesis of the Midas, of the traits of the Ribbono Shel Olam in terms of Yehudai. Amalek is the opposite. That's why Amalek, somebody once told me, Amalek is Rosh Tevis. Ol Malchus Loi Kiblu. The kingdom of heaven Loi Kiblu. They do not recognize a being above them. They're not makabel anything in that sense. They believe only in the supremacy of man, the omnipotence of man. That's why when Chazal refer and they ask Homam, where is Homam Merumas in the Torah? Chazal ask on each one, Esther, where's Homam Merumas in the Torah? Because Anochi Hasti Astai Ponei B'Yomahu. Where's Homam Merumas in the Torah? Because it says, Hamin Ho Eitz, from the tree I told you not to eat. So Homam, Hamin Ho Eitz. But wait a minute, what is that Eitz? That Eitz was the Yodei Tevara. So Haman is Min Ho'etz. Haman didn't eat from the tree of evil. Haman was part of the tree of, that had evil. He was mamish, evil incarnate. That is an Amaleki. That's what Amalek means. To be mamish, evil itself. That's why the Ribbono Shel Olam says that my kingdom and my name will not be Sholem until Amalek is destroyed. It says Yod Al-Kes Yod. That the Ribbono Shel Olam says that my kingdom and my name is not complete shulin until Amalek is destroyed. He's not referring only to the ummah, but he's referring to the, it's the idea that anything who believes that there's anything besides yichud of the Ribbono Shel Olam must be destroyed, and then the Ribbono Shel Olam is shulin. Shleimus in his yichudai. That's why it says, when the Ribbono Shel Olam says, mochui emche, why is it tulak by Bishach, the Ribbono Shel Olam says, I will destroy. It uses tulushonis, whereas by in Kisetze it says Timche, you should destroy, because the Ribbono Shel Olam will destroy them not only mitzad is yichud shlitosoi, but mitzad is mitzius. He will destroy them. Klai Yisrael can only destroy them in terms of the power that they have on earth, but the force of Amalek, the Sitra Achron, and so on, remains. The only the Ribbono Shel Olam can go and destroy the actual force. So therefore, there's the yichud shlitosoi, which is one mechia. When God destroys, what is he really doing? He's bringing out the unity or the yichud of Shlita and emche of his mitzias, that only the Ribbono Shel Olam. You can only be timche. You can blot them out from this world. But the Ribbono Shel Olam can give moche emche from complete, utter existence. That's why there's a double lashon by the Ribbono Shel Olam. And maybe you think that Amalek has something personally against God in the sense that they are really doing damage to God. So the Ribbono Shel Olam says, Zocha asher osu l'cho Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you. Amalek does nothing to Ribbono Shel Olam mitzad atzmusoi. But in terms of your perception of my yichud shlitosoi and my yichud mitzusoi, they are interfering. Zocha asher osu l'cho Amalek. Remember what they did to you. They do not allow you to perceive my yichud mitzius and shlita. They don't do anything personally to me. That's what Ribbono Shel Olam Zocha is asher osu l'cho Amalek. It should just say Zocha is asher osu Amalek. What do you mean l'cho? Because they only do it to you, not to me. The evil they do is not to me, because Ribbono Shel Olam is beyond any damage that Amalek can do. So therefore, we see the ideas of Amalek. What is Esav? Esav is what? Esav's derech is not like Amalek. Even though Esav has murdik gaiva, like a Moloch, but Esav needs a front. He needs religion. Esav has to do his rishus mitzad religion that allows him to do his rishus. Just like Esav, remember Esav? He said, should I mice salt? Remember he went to Yitzchak? What was Esav doing? Esav needs a front. He needs a religion in order to do his evil. Because he fought recognizes some supremacy of the Ribbono Shel Olam. But what he does is he manipulates God to do what he wants. Like the Crusades. They all wanted the Jewish property. So they, what they do is they made killing Jews a holy war. Adrabba, their God commands them to kill Jews. That's what Esav does. Esav goes under the veneer of religion. He needs a front. He needs legitimacy for his evil because he fought recognizes something of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So what he does is he makes his God say exactly what he wants to do. And therefore he's allowed to kill Jews or do any evil he wants. That's the difference between Esav and Amalek. You start out like an Esav because Esav had contact with Yitzchak and Yaakov, where you must recognize the Ribbono Shel Olam, right? And therefore, but you want to fordo your evil, your gaiva, so you use them as a front. You make believe you're from. And eventually you descend into an Amalek, where you throw off the whole veneer of religion and you don't need it. And you go after religion. And that's what Amalek did. That's why the Ribbono Shel Olam is v'loyori Elokim. They were not fearing the Ribbono Shel Olam. They don't fear God. V'loyori Elokim goes on Amalek, not on Klal Yisrael. Which means that Amalek didn't fear God whatsoever. Adrabba, they want to destroy the people that were bringing the message that only the Ribbono Shel Olam is supreme. That is the difference between Esav and Amalek, and that's clearly the difference between America and Germany. What was Germany, which is Zich Amalek, and the Goyen holds that the Amalek, what was Hitler's, Yimach Shemoy, what was his, he wanted to kill the Jews, mitzad what they were bringing to the world. Hitler hated Jews purely because they existed. Hitler believed in what? In the Aryan, the superhuman, the concept of Nietzsche, the idea of an Aryan race. Man was God. So therefore, what Hitler did and what Germany did was destroy Jews in the same characteristic that Amalek would destroy. America, which is Esav, personifies Esav, because Esav is really Christianity, does all the gaiva and taiva they want under the veneer of religion. That's the difference. Again, you see the difference between the way Amalek handles its riches and the way Esav handles its riches. Same idea between Esav and Amalek. So therefore, we see that Amalek is the quintessence of gaiva or evil, whereas Esav goes about legitimizing what it does in religion, but still doing its gaiva and its riches. And we see that illustrated by Hamino 8 of what Amalek is, Rosh Tevis and so on. Not only that, but there's a you know, it says Rak Rak La Yoyim, that the, in the times of Noach or before, that the inclination of man's heart is always evil, and all Rak Rak Kol Hayom, he does evil all day. Rak Rak Kol Hayom, I think the Ger Rebbe says, the Seif of the Tevis is Amalek. Amalek does Rak Rak Kol Hayom, or he only does evil, because he is the quintessence of evil. This is what the idea of Amalek is. So therefore, interestingly enough, we now see that where did Amalek come in the Torah? In Bishalach. Where did they come right before Kabbalah Sotera? Was Amalek. Amalek comes right before Kabbalah Sotera, right? What was Purim? Kabbalah Sotera. Who is the one who precedes Kabbalah Sotera by Purim? Also Amalek. You find, therefore, that the idea why Haman was an Amaleki, because the whole idea of Purim was that the Yidin would be Mekabel Torah B'Ahava. Mekabel Torah B'Ahava, then what always comes before the Yidin Mekabel Torah is the force of Amalek to destroy that Kabbalah before it can take shape. And we find the exact parallel in the Torah. Amalek is in the end of Bishalach, right before Yisrael, right? Haman is right before Kabbalah Torah by Purim. So in other words, the Sitra Achra, the force, which is really Amalek, the Gaiva, wants to destroy the entire Indian of Kabbalah. So they attempt to destroy the Jews before they will get Kabbalah's Torah. That's the Sitra Achra's ploy. That's the way he wants to do before the Yidna Mekabel Torah, because of course Torah will eventually destroy the Sitra Achra. Therefore you have Amalek before Kabbalah's Torah by Nechumish, by Bishalach, and you have Amalek, which is Haman, before Kabbalah Satera by Purim. So therefore, by understanding Purim as a Kabbalah Satera, we understand why Haman turned out to be an Amaleki, because that's exactly the one who goes after you, is the Amalek. Because Amalek is the opposite of what Torah says. Torah is Kabbalah's Omar HaShemayim, the Rotzen HaBore, which restricts man, limits man, and Gaivor says man can do anything he wants. Amalek is the antithesis of what the Torah says. Torah says that man is subjugated to a higher power, namely the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he has to subjugate all his actions to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Amalek says man is the supreme. Let's kill the Jews before they bring that message. So we've now seen what Purim sort of essentially is, that the idea of Purim as a Gemara of Kabbalah Sotera B'Avo answers many questions. And also we understand now the union of Amalek. What characteristics are Amalek? You can almost identify nations by the way how they behave. What characteristics Amalek has? And it's interesting that Yosef HaTzadik, who's the forerunner of the Mashiach ben Yosef, who's Magal Yehudai, understood that Jews cannot fraternize. When the Jews came to Mitzrayim, what did he do? He put them in the land of Goshen. He put them away. But then it says, Vatimolei Horetz Eisom. After Yosef died, the earth was full of them. And what is the next pasuk? Vayokem Melech Chodesh. Right after Vatimolei Horetz Eisom, the whole Mitzrayim was full of Jews. Jews did not stay in the boundary of Goshen. They started spreading and fraternizing with the Mitzrayim. Vatimolei Horetz Eisom. The whole land was full of them, beyond Goshen. What's the next pasuk? Vayokem Melech Chodesh, which began the Tzaras of Eden. So Moshe, who was the forerunner, of course, Mashiach ben Yosef, realized that the only the Yichud Mitzius of the Yichud Terosoi, therefore he's separating Goshen, but the Eden, of course, spread out, and therefore again Mitzrayim came upon them. These are some of the ideas of Purim that I just wanted to share with you. Last week, what we've been talking about so far is the entire idea of psychological phenomena and how we can understand them in terms of certain principles of Hashkofa. And what we begin to see is that one can actually explain many of the psychological phenomena that we observe, many of the fundamental drives in people, based on Hashkofa itself. And what I want to do this week is, I'm still haven't finished the shir in the idea of psychological phenomena as explained by Hashkofa principles. So what I want to do is review what we've covered last week, and then I want to go over the questions that I asked previously, which I didn't really answer. I did a very rushed, so I just want to go over clearly each question and answer it. So I'm going to give a review and then go back over those questions that I asked, and then we'll continue on to an understanding of what the Yetzer Tov is, the good inclination is, in terms of psychological manifestation. Now, if you recall that what we saw last week was the idea that the neshama, when it enters the guf, undergoes or experiences certain changes in terms of the way it feels about itself, what it recognizes, and so on. One of those things that it experiences is that it is severed from its relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Previously it was in a state of dvekus, and now, and therefore it was feeling a sense of what? Of perfection, of being. Once the neshama is inserted in that body, what happens? Then that state of dvekus is gone. The body is now an obstacle to that state. So obviously, if it's severed from its relationship to the Ribbono Shel Olam, then what happens is that it does not feel the shlemus, the perfection. So it obviously has less of a sense of being than it had previously. So therefore, what I'm saying is that the neshama now begins to feel a deficiency in self. Its feelings of self, I, whatever, ego, whatever you want to call it, it feels less. It doesn't feel as if it's a real self. This is what's happening as a result of the fact that it's inserted into the guf. So we begin to see an existential deficiency or feeling of a lack of being. If you want to call that an existential inferiority, okay. As a result of the fact that it becomes man, which is an neshama in a body, it now begins to experience existential inferiority, a lack of being. So this is the beginning or understanding of a fundamental drive, which has its origin in the neshama. Now, what happens when the person now, as he gets older? So I explained last week that the idea of the neshama not experiencing this drive, the neshama now wants to do the opposite, to assert or confirm its existence, to reaffirm, right? To corroborate its being as a result of the fact that it existentially feels a loss of being. So therefore, when the person grows up as an infant, what does he do? Since he has that need, which is the deficiency of being, he then begins to have feelings of omnipotence, which of course is trying to fulfill the need. He feels a lack of being, so the infant begins to have that feeling of omnipotence, the infantile omnipotent fantasies. But if you recall, he does that through a process called primary process, where he merely wields to feel like a being, and poof, he is. And I mentioned that the idea of primary process thinking, which is a divine act really, because who ever heard of somebody willing and something happening? Only the Rebbeinu Shlom can do that. That's only spiritual beings do that. Man has to act in order to get things done. Spiritual beings merely will and things get done. But in any case, the neshama retains that illusion, or rather that trait of primary process thinking, and it tries to use it as an infant. But it doesn't work, of course, because in the world of physical world, you can only get things done by physically interacting with the world. So it has the illusion that it can get feelings of omnipotence merely by willing it or feeling it. But of course, since the infant has an unsophisticated ego, it's not aware that the world, there's a whole world of reality that you must interact with that world to get things done. So therefore, it tries to do it this way. And that's the entire idea of magical thinking, also primary process thinking. And I had mentioned that the idea of primary process thinking continues in the adult life also, in terms of dreams, daydreams, when a person fantasizes and so on. The fact the person attempts always continuously to try to achieve some fulfillment of a deficiency or a need by thinking about it. And lo and behold, when you think about many things, you get a vicarious sense of fulfillment. That's the reason why it actually works. There is something that is going on. And that's the reason why the neshama attempts this particular operation, or rather the person attempts, because it still has the vestige in terms of when it was a neshama without a guf. Now, as the person gets older, what happens? His ego, the self, becomes much more sophisticated. It perceives reality. And it knows that in order to get anything done, to fulfill any needs, you must involve yourself with the world. Right? Obviously you have to involve yourself with the world. So what the person does in order to get a sense of self, right? It now has to involve itself with the world. Now, as an adult or even as a child, that feeling that a person wants to get, that he feels like somebody, like something, is called self-worth. So what's being understood now is that the drive, the psychological need, and therefore the psychological drive, of self-worth, self-esteem, self-respect, whatever you want to call it, has its origins in the spiritual universe, namely the origins in the fact that the neshama was separated from the Rebbeinu Shlom. And that manifests itself in Adam as a drive for self-worth. So therefore, in order to get the self-worth, it must involve itself in the world, which it recognizes as a sophisticated ego. It sees that it must involve itself in the world. So it gets involved in the world in one of four ways. One of the ways of this re-establishing a feeling or a sense of being is by expressing one's will. When a person expresses will, when he exercises being, in other words, he expresses will, he gets a sense of being. Because you feel like something when you are acting as a thing. You know, when you're acting as that which you are, you feel that you are that thing. So a person gets a sense of self by acting as a Adam, as a self, and that is, it expresses its will. It expresses its will in terms of pleasures, whatever it wants to do. It goes this way, pleasures, whatever tivus, or whatever pleasures or drives that the person has. That's one way it gets a sense of a sense of self. The second way, another way of getting a sense of self, is the idea of productivity. When you are productive, when you are successful, then you have a tremendous sense of being, of self. You feel great about yourself. You feel as if you're something. Unfortunately, people get carried away and they feel they're everything because they're very successful in business or whatever. But the idea of productivity is one of the ways of getting a sense of self. That's a second way. A third way is by achieving mastery, control, or power over other beings. And of course, that also gives you a sense of self. When you have these kind of control, because by controlling other beings, one gets a sense of their own being. It's an illusion of potency. That's the idea of omnipotence, potency. You can get things done. Another way is the idea, of course, of not only of expressing will or being productive or controlling. And possessions, by the way, comes in the idea of control. The drive to have possessions, really, because the more things you possess, obviously the more things you control. But besides those three ideas is also the idea of the way an Neshama gets its sense of self, in the sense that it wants to have the ability to be able to control others, even if it doesn't outwardly do it. And how does it do that? By acquiring money. Money, even if you never use it, gives one an incredible sense of self. I mean, if you have $1 million in the bank, you feel great, even if you don't use it. Because you know that you have the ability to do whatever you want. Just the ownership of money. Because money provides you with the wherewithal to do almost anything really you want. So therefore you try to acquire money also. And we find that the Torah alludes to these four ways. As I mentioned last week, where the Torah says that you will forget the Lord and not do His mitzvahs. Why? Because you will eat and be satisfied. That's the expression will having tivus. The next statement the Torah says, and you will build houses and live in it. Building houses, productivity. The third idea the Torah says, and you will have a lot of cattle, possession. And the fourth idea is, and you will acquire a lot of money. Money. I mean, literally the four ways. And what will happen as a result? You're going to say that it's my power that has gotten me all these goods. And the Roshim is not your power, it's my power that's the one who's gotten you these goods. So we see that the Roshim himself tells you that you're going to have this drive, and that you're going to do these things, and what's going to happen is you're going to get one of several levels of a sense of self. Either you're going to feel self-complacent, which means even if you are outwardly okay, you're not condescending or arrogant, but you, it's like they say in Yiddish, mahalzich von sich. You hold from yourself, you know. Because even though you outwardly talk like a nice person, but there's certain people who talk like a nice person, you can see that he's in love with himself. He really thinks he's God's gift. Even though he doesn't treat you bad, that's all self-complacent. That's one form of gaiva, which is really what we're talking about now, the sense of self. The second sense of self, of course, is arrogance. Arrogance is where you have a sense of self as superior to others also. That's the second. That's called arrogance, haughtiness, whatever. And that's usually the form we recognize it in immediately. The third sense of self a person gets, and you'll notice it gets worse and worse in the sense of how more central the person becomes, is when a person becomes a megalomaniac, egomaniac, where he thinks that not only is he somebody, not only is he greater than you, but he's the only thing around. You see, that's egomaniacal thinking. That's delusions of grandeur, grandiosity, omnipotent fantasies, any kind of paranoid delusions you want to entertain. That's what it's all about. There the person has this incredible distorted sense of self as being the greatest being of all. Forget about better than others. The greatest of all, even greater than God, if he admits there is a God altogether. And of course, if he does admit there's a God, he will usually wind up saying that, I am God, which is what you find many psychotic people saying. I am God, or I am some famous, and so on, whatever. That's the different levels of grandiosity. So therefore, those are the three sense of selves. And you see, of course, one is more and more distorted as time goes on. That a person gets by doing one of the four ways, right? In order to achieve what? The need to feel like a self, which was taken away after the neshama was inserted or went into the guf. You recall that I had asked many questions previously, and very intriguing questions. And let's see now if we have the information necessary to answer these questions. The first question was, what is the fundamental psychological drive or need, and then you have a drive as a result of the need, that mankind has. And the answer is that even psychologically, the most fundamental need of all is self-worth. More things are done in the quest for self-worth, more activities are done than anything, any other need or drive. And even if it looks like you're doing things in order to survive, self-preservation, the truth is that self-worth is goes piggyback on those other things too. Because every time you do something to survive, you're also achieving a sense of self. There are many things you do just to get a sense of self. You want to go out and develop a hobby, do something meaningful or whatever. But even when you do things which are in quest of preservation, of survival, going for a living, going for this, taking a new course, whatever, there's always a sense of self as a result of the fact that you are involved in life, exercising being, or whatever, mastery, or you're acquiring possessions. There's always something going on that's feeding you the sense of self. So we begin to understand that the fundamental psychological drive is really self-worth. And we begin to understand that the reason why a person has a drive for self-worth is because it originates in a spiritual phenomena, namely the fact that the neshama was placed in the guf. It's a psychological need. We see it psychologically, right? But it really emanates from the interaction between the neshama and the guf. This is what we begin to see is a fundamental psychological need and drive. Now, what is the fundamental psychological conflict? Now, we all know what a conflict is. A conflict is the anticipated frustration that you experience when you choose one of several alternatives. Obviously, you can only choose one alternative out of many, and the frustration that you feel is the conflict. That's what a conflict is. When you feel frustrated, because you can only choose one alternative out of one or out of two or many, and you feel frustrated as a result. That's why conflict is such tremendous stress, because you don't know which one to choose. And there are different kinds of conflict. But in order to have a conflict, you must have opposing or different choices which oppose each other, in the sense that if you choose one, you do not get the other. Right? It's got to have there has to be an opposite one way and the other way. At least in the sense that if you get either or, if you get one, you don't get the other. That's what conflict is all about. If you can get both at the same time, there wouldn't be any conflict. So the idea that we're trying to understand now is, what is the fundamental conflict that we understand in terms of Yiddishkeit? And the answer to that is, the fundamental conflict is, does one think he is somebody, or does one think he's nobody? Or rather, that the Rabbanu Shalom is everything. So we're back down to that fundamental rule of Einoid Muvadoi, that only the Rabbanu Shalom is a true being and exists, or Yeshid Muvadoi. Besides the Rabbanu Shalom, there's also myself. And of course, some people say that there is no Rabbanu Shalom, and there's only himself. That's not even a yesh oid. There's only self. Of course, but that's the furtherance of feelings of self, which we've gone into, the grandiosity and so on. But the fundamental conflict of an odom in every mitzvah he does, okay, is, and in other words, religion or Judaism imposes itself on you and says, I am going to force you to choose between the Rabbanu Shalom or yourself. Everything you do, Yiddishkeit is telling you that that is the choice. And I had illustrated how every mitzvah, both in its content and in its form, its surah, always has that underlying battle. Einoid Mavadoi or Yeshid Mavadoi. And the Rebbeinu Shalom puts you into that situation where you will always be conflicted by having to choose between yourself or having to choose between, or having to choose on the side of the Rebbeinu Shalom, that he is Einoid Mavadoi. That's the fundamental conflict. And we begin to understand that in order to have a conflict, you must have two sides, right? If the Rebbeinu Shalom wants me to choose that he is the only one, there must be an opposing tendency where I want to say that I am also something. And then I have a war. Am I something or is he something only? Right? So therefore the tendency of a man to say that he is something is the drive for self-worth. That creates the conflict or the other side. There's a need or a drive in the opposite direction that he says that he is somebody. And that comes about, as I mentioned, because of a spiritual origin. On the other side, there's the alternative direction by negating your own self-worth in a certain sense, not self-respect, but by negating the idea that you are something, and you say that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is the only thing. And what tells you to do that? Torah. When the Rabbeinu Shel Olam gave the Torah, and he gave the mitzvahs, and he says, observe the commandments, you're always conflicted. Should I do the commandments because he said, or should I do what I want to do? So by his giving the Torah, and by his giving you the feelings of self-worth, you are immediately conflicted. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam has now beautifully set the stage, psychologically, for a melchoma, where you will have to war, where you will have to war constantly between an assertion of self or an assertion of the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. And every mitzvah, it deals with all the different areas that you interact, because in every area you're saying you're somebody. So you'll notice that all the 630 mitzvahs involve in all the different areas, and in every area you have to say you're nobody. That's why 630 mitzvahs are spread over so many areas. Ownership, if you recall, I had gone through the mitzvahs. Because in all the areas that the mitzvahs encompass, basically encompass all the areas of man's activity. And in every area of activity, you want to say you're somebody, the mitzvah is staring in the face to say, you're nobody. And by saying you're nobody, what happens? Then the Rebbeinu Shel Olam comes back into the universe, if you remember the ideas of Tzimtzum, because the Rebbeinu Shel Olam says, since you declared that I am the only one, I will now come back into the world, and reality will reflect my unity. And therefore history reflects the amount of Hester and Haor and the Bria. It all goes back to the exact same thing. But the idea here is that in order to give man the constant, or set the stage for the conflict, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam gives him mitzvahs on one side, and on the second side, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam gives him a drive for worth. And that is the fundamental conflict of all. You see how it interestingly integrates why the drive is a necessity in order to put yourself in the mechoma of what the Rebbeinu Shel Olam wants. You either declare the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is Eined Mevadoi, or you declare that Yesh Eined Mevadoi. This is the idea of the fundamental psychological conflict, and why it is there, and what it means. Because the psychological need is given to make sure you will be conflicted. Now that we have a status of war, you must choose which one, and that's the Yegiyah, that's the Amelus, that's the effort that you have to put in. And as a result of that amelus, that effort, you get schar or whatever. Everything is based on that conflict. So hopefully what we now have is a very clear understanding that the psychological phenomena that you see is there to make sure that you will accomplish what you're here for. And that is to do the task of what? Einel Mevadoi or Yeshe Mevadoi. So Rebbeinu Shel Olam actually forms the psychological apparatus of a man to reflect that. Because that's what Rebbeinu Shel Olam wants you to do. In addition, now, the next question which I asked was, what do we need self-worth for? It doesn't make sense. We don't need it for self-preservation. Remember I went through those psychological needs, adequacy, security, and so on? And the idea was that each one made sense because each one is necessary for you to do things which make sure that you keep living. You'll maintain the conditions of life. But then I asked the question on, what about self-worth? What do you need it for? What do I have to feel like I'm somebody? I don't need it to keep living. I have to feel adequate, because if I feel inadequate, I'll have to go out and develop competencies which will make sure I live. But what do I have to feel like I'm somebody? What do I need it for? The answer is, you don't need it for physical survival. But you need it for the ruchniyastige melchoma, for the spiritual war that you must have. That's why you have it. The fourth question that I had asked is, what do you always have to prove it for? You exist. Remember I said existence is its own worth. I don't have to prove I am. I am. Because I'm sitting here giving a shiur, right? The answer to that is, you really don't have to prove it. But because there's an existential inferiority from the fact that you became Adam, a neshama into a guf, therefore you must prove to yourself that you are something. But the truth is, of course you are something. But you feel as if you're not, because you are now severed from the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. So you begin to get what's called existential gaiva. You receive existential inferiority by the fact that you are Adam. And the fact that you are an Adam now means that you are now striving to undo that feeling. and begin to feel like you're something. That's the idea of existential gaiva. And so therefore, why prove it? You don't have to prove it. But the spiritual phenomenon which occurred forces you to engage in some kind of proof that you are something. Because the truth, what you feel, is merely an illusion, actually. But it's set up in order to make sure that you are war with yourself. The other question, the next question we asked was, what is true worth then? What is true worth? Because I had asked, wait a minute. Because no matter how you feel about yourself, if you recall, it's all relative. If you grew up feeling very bad about yourself because you were not good intellectually, but let's say you were very good in sports. So the question was, if had you been brought up with parents who were crazy about sports, you would feel great about yourself. So it's not because you really are worthless. It's because you were brought up in a family who didn't value your particular attribute. So therefore, your feelings about self, whether they be good or bad, is really not true. It all depends on what circumstance you were brought up in. If you were brought up in a circumstance where your parents are on welfare, of course you're going to feel inferior. If you were brought up in a circumstance where your parents have everything, you're going to feel great about yourself. But there's no reality to the real feelings that each one has. They merely feel that way because of the particular circumstances they were born. It's relative. So the question is then, your feelings of worth are relative, so the truth is they're really arbitrary. They don't really say what you're really worth. It's an illusion in that sense. So the question is, what is the true worth? And the answer to that is, true worth is not what you do, or productivity, or anything like that. A person gets a true sense of worth by declaring the unity of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Do you ever notice a tzaddik? A tzaddik is always doing something for the sake of God. Remember? He always negates his self-interest, right? Remember, there's two kinds of mitzvahs. A mitzvah that you would do even without the Ribbono Shel Olam commanding you. And then there's a mitzvah you would do, and the only reason why you're doing it is because he said to do it, right? Whatever. So those mitzvahs which you would do even if he didn't command you, so the whole purpose, the makoma, is to get your self-interest out of that mitzvah and to do it only for his interest, which is nachas ruach, right? To give him a sense of satisfaction, kaviyochel, right? Of course, God doesn't feel that way, but in human terms, that's what it means. In the mitzvahs that you don't want to do it, then you do what? You express his unity by doing what he wants. In other words, you do only for his self-interest because obviously you don't want to do it. So there's always one of two ways you approach a mitzvah. You would do it anyway, or you would never do it unless he commanded you. In both, the idea is to remove self-interest. That's the whole avodah. Which means, of course, that since he's the only being, it's only his interest that counts. So if that's the case, if a tzaddik is always doing that, he's always doing something for the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he never has any self-interest whatsoever, this man should have a whopping inferiority complex. How does he have any sense of self? When he's successful in job, it's not me who does this. It's only the Ribbono Shel Olam that does it, right? So he denies himself the feeling that he gets from productivity. When he's doing anything, any pleasurable, he tries to minimize the pleasure, and he says that it's only the Ribbono Shel Olam. Since he wants me to do it, that's why I'm doing it. And I don't want to experience any self-interest. Money, he tries not to collect. He's always giving away tzedakah, so he's not going to get any feelings of self from that. Possessions, he's always trying to minimize, and even if he does, he says, I don't really own it. It's all the Ribbono Shel Olam, and if I own it, it's merely to manage it and to give it away or whatever. So the point is that the tzaddik is always doing something which doesn't give him any self-worth. So why doesn't all tzaddikim feel like inferiority people? Why don't they feel inferior? And we look at a tzaddik, we see that there's a tremendous sense of self. There's a murdic strength. When you look at a tzaddik, there's a murdic strength that emanates from him. A power. If you want to look at like Baba Chereva, you don't feel any feelings that he feels inferior about himself. There's a murdic sense, not of gaiva, but of self, of strength that emanates from him. Where did he get that? If he's not doing anything that gives people a sense of self, right? Seems to be a contradiction. The answer is that he has the greatest sense of self, because when a person does the Ratzon Hashem, then somehow he gets a hashpah from the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, a spiritual nourishment in that sense, where he mamash feels like himself. And really, it's what makes sense. When you declare the Ribbono Shel Olam is Einoi Mevadoi, what happens? You begin feeling the Ribbono Shel Olam again, because he comes back to you. Since you are testifying to his unity, if you begin experiencing him back again. you begin feeling more shlemus. So even on a physical level or a psychological level, you begin experiencing the contact with the Ribbono Shel Olam, except you're not aware that it's He. But you begin feeling that tremendous sense of self, because you are, what's happening is on a spiritual level, you're slowly reuniting yourself with the Ribbono Shel Olam in a certain way. And that gives you a tremendous sense of self, which is true self-worth. So if you ask me what the true self-worth is, the answer is how closely are you allied to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because the fact that you see tzaddikim shows you that they immediately feel that way, when they shouldn't. So where are they getting their sense of self? And the answer, because they're getting their sense of self from the only way to get their sense of self. And that is by doing the mitzvahs for the Ribbono Shel Olam, and the Ribbono Shel Olam himself begins to be mashpia on a ruchnis, a spiritual level, and they begin feeling it, and as the greatest sense of strength. It automatically happens, but it's beyond the physical. Okay? So this is the understanding of where you really get your true sense of worth. So if you really want that true sense of worth, I advise you very heartily to engage in mitzvahs, because that's really when you feel it. There's a pasuk that says, "Bechol derochecho da'ehu," in all your ways, know him. That's what it means. In all your ways means not only in mitzvahs, but in anything you do, when you walk downstairs or whatever, da'ehu, be aware of his part in your life, in the sense that you exist because he wants you to be. And you can only get things done because he allows that to happen. That's what it means. Da'i, you know him. Not that he's absent most of the year, and then every once in a while we think of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Shivisi Hashem Negdi Summit. And that people who reach that madriga have the greatest sense of worth of all. Now, let's go further. We also begin to understand why the Adam, as an infant, uses what's called primary process thinking. And the answer is because primary process thinking is an operation which is a divine operation. But the soul still has feelings, or rather, it still does things as a result of it being neshama, yet obviously in this world it doesn't work. So therefore it leaves off that way of handling problems, and it goes into reality testing, where it actually goes into reality and tries to solve its problem. But the reason why it started out as an infant with this primary process problem-solving ability is because that's what it did before it entered the guf. You see? So that primary process is like a vestigial process that the neshama could use if it's out of the guf, but when it's in the guf, it's void. It cannot use that. It must relegate, or it must be tied to the ways of the world. And that is, you can only get things done by acting and doing, not by willing or thinking. A person must experience primary process thinking, not as an infant, but as an adult, in dreams, for instance. What does a dream do? You know that many times you strive for something in the daytime hours when you're awake and you can't get it. And the frustration on that is very difficult to keep going. So what a person does is he dreams about that he has it in the dream, and that actually alleviates some of the frustration. So dreaming actually enables you to keep going. It alleviates a lot of the frustration of what you desire during the day. But dreaming would have no meaning if you couldn't reduce the drive. So primary process thinking reduces somewhat of the drive. So the idea of primary process thinking, in order to enable you to go on and not be so frustrated and dream about it at night, is an important feature to enable a person to go on. That's why primary process thinking continues. Now, the next question, of course, was why does an infant have omnipotent fantasies? Where does it come from? And the answer, because it's an immediate response or reaction to the fact that it has an existential inferiority, and therefore it immediately wants to feel like something. And that's how it arises. Except because the ego is not sophisticated, it thinks it can do it through primary process. As it begins to have a sophisticated ego, it still goes after the omnipotent fantasies, but in a different way, in the realistic way. Money and possessions and so on. And the primary process thinking or pattern that I used before, that method goes underground in terms of dreams or daydreams. Because you daydream if you're not making it in life. So you daydream. You know, and people who are more failures, they daydream even more. Because that's the only way. So you go back to the old way of getting things done or getting a sense of self. For instance, those people who always have dreams of daydreams of hero, they're always dreaming they're a hero of some sort, whatever, they because obviously they're a great failure in their lives, so they're going back to the old process that the child used, which is primary process thinking, which originated from the real powers of the neshama. Except the person should drop that and get involved in the world. So we understand that a man is always striving for omnipotent fantasies, except at the infant level he uses the method called primary process thinking. At the adult level he uses what's called secondary process or reality testing, where he actually gets involved in reality. But no matter what he's doing, he's always trying to prove himself something, some sense of self-worth. And you either wind up with some kind of self-complacency, arrogance, or egomania, whatever. Or hopefully you won't wind up with any of those things. You wind up as an anif, which leads us into the next question of what is gaiva and what is anivus. If you recall, I asked you, what does it mean gaiva? Gaiva means haughtiness, overbearingness, arrogance. And what does it mean by anivus? Humbleness, humility. Okay? Are these just traits or are they fundamental, pivotal levels or trait? And the answer is, of course, they're pivotal. They're not just a trait. When Torah says you should be an onuf, what is it really saying? It's saying that you should recognize ein eid mevadoi. That's what an onuf is. What have we come to the conclusion of a gaiva and an onuf? That a gaiva is what? Is he who says, I am something too, yesh eid mevadoi. And an onuf is somebody who says, ein eid mevadoi, I'm really nothing. But that's exactly the melchama. So gaiva, or the statement of yesh eid mevadoi, is that which you should avoid, conquer. And ein eid mevadoi, which is the idea of anivus, is what you should win over or make part of yourself. And when you say ein eid mevadoi in all your activities, what are you called? An anuf. You are called an anuf because in every activity you are saying ein eid mevadoi. So it comes out that an anuf is the level, the desired and the objective of our entire quest is to be the onuf, which means to say ein eid mevadoi in all areas of man's activities. The gaiva, which is yesh eid mevadoi, is the opposite. It's the idea that you're yesh eid mevadoi in all the areas, and that's exactly what you're not supposed to say, because the fundamental war is ein eid mevadoi, which is anivus, and yesh eid mevadoi, which is gaiva. So we see that gaiva and anivus is not just a midah, a character trait, a good thing to have. It's the fundamental trait to have. Because when you're an onuf, you have reached your objective in terms of what you must comprehend, and that is ein eid mevadoi. So as a reward, what do we call you? An onuf. So when you do that consistently, you're now called an onuf. And you have that pattern of declaring ein eid mevadoi. Now, it's interesting that Chazal say certain interesting statements about ein eid mevadoi. It says, "Kol odam sheish be gasas ruach." Any person that has gasas ruach, which means gaiva, is ki'ilu oved avodah zarah, as if he worshipped idols. That's what Chazal say. So the question is, what does worshipping idols have to do with thinking being haughty? So the answer is obvious. When you are about gaiva, what are you really saying? That there's God and me. But you're saying that there's a being besides God. So what do you really believe in? False idols. You are the false idol. It's referring to the self. It's ki'ilu oved avodah zarah, as if. The language is as if you worship strange idols. You're not literally worshiping a strange idol. You're worshiping yourself. You've become that strange idol because you are saying that I am something too besides Ribbono Shel'olam. That's the obvious connection between when you're about gaiva, you're also worshipping strange idols, namely self, because worship strange idols means that you believe in something besides the Ribbono Shel'olam. And in this case, you believe in self besides the Ribbono Shel'olam. And of course, that is a false idol. Also, we see by Moshe Rabbeinu that the relationship between anivus, okay, and also ein eid mevadoi. I'm saying that anivus is what? That humility is really the pattern of a person who always recognized ein eid mevadoi. What did Moshe Rabbeinu say? V'anachnu mo. What are we? We are nothing, right? And what does the Torah say about Moshe Rabbeinu? V'ho'ish Moshe onuv mikol odom sheba'aretz. And the man Moses was the most humble man on earth. And the Torah is saying that Moshe Rabbeinu is the most humble man on earth. Nobody beats him. But was that an accident? No. Because Moshe realized, Einei Mevadoi, because he said, Vanachnu Mo, what am I? Mo, nothing. What am I? Nothing. Therefore, he was the greatest on earth, because that's exactly what Anivus is. Vanachnu Mo is on earth Mikol Odom Shebaaretz. And since he had the greatest hasoga, the greatest comprehension of Einei Mevadoi of the Rebbeinu Shalom, because he actually was in Shemayim, and he witnessed in Kabbalah Sotera, he went up to Har Sinai and so on. Therefore, logically, he would comprehend the greatest Einei Mevadoi, so therefore, we could predict that he would be the greatest Anuf. Simple, it's a logical conclusion. One follows from the other. And it says that, V'ho'ish Moshe, Anuf Mikol Odom Shebaaretz, he was greater than any man in Anivus, humility. Any man, it doesn't say he was the greatest humble being, it says he was the greatest man. That means there's somebody greater than him. Who in Anivus, you know who they are? The Malachim. The Malachim are greater in humility than Moshe, which is obvious, because they stand right next to the Rebbeinu Shlom. So their perception of Einei Mevadoi is greater than Moshe Rabbeinu's. So therefore they're even greater in its humility. So we see there's an incredible correlation here, that once you've got the key, once you understand what Gaiv and Anivus, many Chazals get answered in terms of what they're really saying. Now, so therefore we begin to understand what Anivus and Gaiva is. We can understand why the Mesilas Yesharim places Anivus as a level, because it is a level. When you are an Anuf, what you really are is a person who consistently, in every act, is saying Einei Mevadoi. So it's not one trait. It's an attitude toward everything. So therefore it's a level. That on every act you do, you've got the attitude of a Anuf. Everything is Einei Mevadoi. And why does the Mesilas Yesharim, which was of course written by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Matzatoi, which is the system that we're using, why is it the last, the greatest level? Because the greatest level is Einei Mevadoi. That is the end. In the end, the man has to say Einei Mevadoi. Or to put it another way, when a person's dying, what's the statement he's got to say? Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Again, Einei Mevadoi. So you're always testifying to Einei Mevadoi. Therefore, Einei Mevadoi, or in a descriptive term of a man, it's called a Anuf, is the greatest level, it's the final level, and it's of course the last level. That's why it's in the end of Mesilas Yesharim. So that's the ideas of what Anivus and Gaiva. Then we also went into the idea of the, I gave you two instances of Gaiva. Two kinds of people, right? One who is very nice guy, but he's always into living, doing what he wants, right? But he's a nice guy, he doesn't speak condescendingly, he relates very well with people, but he loves to enjoy himself. I mean, he's into, he works well, he's got a great job and so on. Then the other kind of gaiva was a man who's very haughty, if you recall. So I asked him, which one is the real gaiva? And the answer is, they're both bar gaivas. But one is what's called a gevalev. He is haughty in his heart. He's self-complacent. This man is into doing what he wants. He doesn't feel he's greater than you. But he feels like he's a somebody. Self-complacency. But he doesn't feel he's better than you. But he feels like we're all somebodies. So he's into doing whatever he wants, expressing his will. That's gaiva. Because when you express your will for the sense of feeling like somebody, you want to do things because you want to do them. You feel that you're working and you're making a living because of your powers. You want to go to a great restaurant and enjoy because you're hungry and you want to satisfy your pleasure. What is that? That's gaiva of the self-complacency form. The other guy is the obvious bar gaiva. He's the arrogant, where he feels superior to other people. But the truth is they're both bar gaivas. Because they're both declaring what? Yeshid Mevadoi. And that's what gaiva is. But it's in different levels, as I pointed out, that there are three different levels. So that gives us an understanding of what bar gaiva is. But don't be fooled. Many people are bar gaivas, gvalev. They are haughty in their heart, even though they may be very nice people. But they are still looking at it as moody bar gaivas, because they hold from zich. They hold from themselves as really being somebody. Also, we went into the idea of what's the difference between self-respect and gaiva, which is a very important question. Many people fail to understand. But now we can understand it. Self-respect and gaiva. Gaiva is when a person has a distorted sense of self. In other words, I am the one who gets everything done. I have talents because I am really somebody. It is my being. Since I'm a being, therefore I have all these talents. I'm so intelligent, right? I've made the money because of my cunningness and so on. That's Gaiva. Because nothing you did is because of you. But a person who has self-respect is that whatever the Rabbeinu Shalom gave me, I can really do. What's the opposite of self-respect? Inferiority, where a person says, nah, I can't think very well, I can't do this, I'm inadequate, or I'm inferior, and so on. That's false. Because if the Rabbeinu Shalom gave you intelligence, then you could use your intelligence. So a person has to have self-respect. He has to respect the self in terms of what he has, which means in terms of what was given to him. That if God gave me intelligence, it means I can use it. Not that I can't go or I can't learn because I really have poor intelligence. You know, I have very poor confidence in my abilities to perform in thinking or in anything. That's wrong. Because the Rebbe Hashem gave you the wherewithal to do it, you truly can do it. So self-respect is the belief that what God gave you, because He is the real being, and what He gave you, you can really use. Gaiva is the sense that the reason why you have these things is because you are somebody. You see the difference? Clearly the difference between self-respect and gaiva. Gaiva is a distortion, and self-respect is a statement that you also can do things because the Rebbeinu Shalom gave them to you to do. So you can do them. There's no business of not being feeling that you can do them. Gaiva is the opposite. It's a distortion of self. And the idea of three kinds of anivus, that was the last question, that there are three kinds of anivus. What does that mean? I describe three kinds of people who are humble. The first one who feels she's a person who's always doing good to others, but you know has a lot of problems, emotional problems, doesn't have a good self-image or whatever. Then the person who looks outwardly, you know, he's very humble, he speaks to you very nicely, but inwardly he seems to hold that he can learn very well and so on. And the person who really you get a real sense of feeling that he really feels as if he's really nothing great. So the answer is that the first person is not an anav, the one who has emotional problems. The person that lacks self-respect. Not that the person has humility, because the person realizes true that God is the only being. True humility is a recognition of Eini Mevadoi. If I feel I'm nobody because I believe I'm nobody, because I believe there's nothing here, and even what God gave me I can't do, that's inferiority, that's shiftless. That's a mental, emotional disorder of inferiority, not anivus. Anivus is a madrega that you have to work through. Shiftless is a disease or a disorder that you get if you come into certain situations. So the first person doesn't have anivus. That first person is, of course, a tremendous sense of inferiority, which he shouldn't have in the first place. He should have self-respect. The second case where a person holds from himself, right? But he's really very nice to people and so on, he's really about gaiva. Because even if he tries to be an honor in the sense that he feels that he wants to relate well with people, but the truth is, since he holds himself, don't be fooled by his acts of humility. You can tell when a person really holds from himself, the self-complacency. And unfortunately, there are many people who are very self-complacent and come across as great, as firmer people in that sense. But there's a difference. A true honor, you really feel his anivus. People who come who feel that they're somebody, and they get, on the contrary, they get a lot of ego trips because they do mitzvahs, but they act from and so on, that's not anivus. That's really gaiva. And the third idea, where a person who really acts humbly all the way, he is a true anuf. Remember, anivus is the perception of Einid Muvadoi, and that takes a lot of yagia and work. But mainly you feel only the Rabbeinu Shalom is the only being. Shiftless or inferiority is not. It's a lack of self-respect, even what the Rabbeinu Shalom gave you. You see? So there's a very big difference between shiftless and anivus.